This Is It is the new book by Conor Creighton. Conor's on the line. How are you doing, Conor?
Hey, Ray. How's it going?
Good. It's a meditation memoir. Is this a new genre, Conor?
I think this is what happens when you pitch a meditation book during a lockdown and then you write it entirely on your own and then it just becomes all about you. I think that's sort of what happened there, Ray.
Right. Well, let's get a bit of the memoir out of the way first. So you were brought up mainly in Salins in County Kildare.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just tell us a bit about your parents.
Yeah, well, my parents are wonderful and gave me some great lessons in life. And but when they just got together and when I was a kid, I guess they were both quite kind of just struggling with a lot of things in life and sort of trying to make ends meet. And my dad was having a rough time then, and he drank quite a lot. And it was just a bit of a tough household for all of us to be in. Mm. And that kind of just led to then me sort of going into school and sort of being a very sensitive kid and coming probably from a slightly rough home life, then kind of going into school where I was a bit awkward and getting bullied and all these things. And, you know, no girls would look at me and so on and so forth. And then I more or less just left when I was 17.
Okay.
I left Ireland when I was 17.
So your dad was from a loyalist background up the north.
Yes.
And what about your mum?
Yes. My mum was from Athy.
Right.
And the two of them met when they were very young. And my mum always tells a very funny story about how my dad had a car that needed to be push started. And his line with her was, "Would you give him a push?" And and she didn't know she'd be doing that like 40 something years later, I suppose. But in the book, I write a little bit about just how it was growing up in that house. But the wonderful thing, and I think this is also the idea of the book, is just the potential for great change. And just to add that, like, my parents are really, have grown into like the most incredible parents. Yeah. And
I
love our relationship now.
I was talking last week about my own upbringing and the fact that our house was a very tense house. Was there tension in your house growing up? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, there was. Yeah. And I think, Ray, to be honest, you know what I mean? That was also just 80s Ireland.
Was it? Yeah.
There was a lot of uncertainty and people didn't know. I mean, there was times when my dad was on the dole. Do you know what I mean? And just times were hard and we didn't have the emotional fluency that I think we do now.
Okay. And you were ginger as well. Was that some aspect of the bullying?
Yeah, possibly. Although in fairness, weren't we all a little bit ginger then? But it's not really something I can get. It's the tiniest of violins to play, I think, right?
Yeah.
But
okay, so
I think it was mostly... Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so
I think it was mostly just been sensitive. Do you know what I mean? Been sensitive and kind of in a place where, like, young boys, we kind of had to be tough. And that didn't always sit so well with me. I wasn't able to do that so well.
Okay. Kildare gets a sort of a bit of a going over in the book. But you've made friends with it again,
sorry.
I think.
Yeah, I even compared it to Tibet. I think that's high praise, isn't it?
but at 17, socially awkward teenager, you just wanted to get out of there. Where did you head to?
I ended up, I took a job up in the Swiss Alps where I was working in a hostel. And then it's very funny. I remember meeting a German girl there and she was a few years older than me. And she was a vegetarian and she had dreadlocks and she read the Beat Poets and she smoked roll-up cigarettes. And I just remember going, I've never met anything like this in my whole life. I've never met anyone so free. So I just copied everything she did. Mm. And she then ended up going off to Australia and working in a carnival and doing all the sort of the cliched young things like growing dreadlocks and walking around barefoot and probably smoking a little bit too much dope and so on and so forth. And that was kind of it. That's where I ran off to.
Right. Do you think you were always heading towards the life you're now following, you know, a meditation teacher?
I mean, sitting here on my little cushion surrounded by meditation books and sort of things like that, yes, I can say that, yes. But like in the murky years of my 20s and early 30s, I had no idea where I was heading. Okay. I just felt like I was heading from one anxious spiral to another. But I suppose that's the great thing about hindsight, and when you do kind of finally emerge with some sort of learning, that you go, ah, that was necessary, and that was necessary, and okay, there was some greater plan.
So to give people an idea of you know, you just said your 20s there, but you were a barman, you traveled around the place, you were into drugs, drink, you suffer from depression, you were all over the place, I suppose, would be a fair assessment, yeah, of your life. Yeah. And when then did you discover meditation?
I remember exactly. The interesting thing though, right, too, is that I heard about meditation on so many occasions, but I've just always been very cynical and always quite close-minded. And it took a breakup, a very dramatic breakup. I'd been engaged to someone, and I thought that this person was finally my cure for depression. This was my road to happiness, you know, blue skies ahead. And then that relationship broke up, and I remember just lying on my carpet. I was age 33, and I'd had a panic attack, and just had this moment where I was like, I'm 33 years of age. Like, what is going on here? How come I haven't got this together? And fortuitously, or magically, or maybe just this is the genius of commerce and marketing, I remembered that I'd got an advert on Facebook that day from Headspace, and downloaded the app. And I think on that first day, I must have listened to an introductory meditation about 60 times. Because every time I did the meditation, Ray, there was a tiny brief second where I felt, oh, maybe it's not all that bad. And that was kind of enough. That was enough for me to sort of be very curious. Mm. And then
how
the other
did you
thing
describe, that, you know, how do you describe meditation to be? I'll just read a paragraph in the book there. Just meditation is very simple, but it's also really hard. You've got to go into it with no expectation, even though you're obviously trying it for a reason. You've got to make some effort, but not too much. You've got to let go without dropping completely off to sleep. You need to be determined, but not grasp. You need to want it, but you also need to not want anything at all. Meditation is very simple, but it's also really hard. And after an entire lifetime, you'll still feel like a beginner. Janie Mackers.
Sounds like Bob Dylan song lyrics now.
Yeah. So what's your pitch, you know, when you meet somebody, probably not in a bar anymore, but you meet somebody and they go, what is this meditation, Connor? What is it?
Well, this is the thing. I feel that meditation is kind of like a radical encounter with yourself. And I think that for the most part, we spend our lives on autopilot. We go around doing things, not really from a sense of intuition, but from a sense of habit. You know, I wear these clothes because I've always worn these clothes. I do this job because this is the job that I kind of came to me. I eat these foods. And meditation is sort of a technique for learning how to just become aware of what you're doing. Like, and I think the clearest example is this, and it's one that we all have, is like, do you ever find yourself in the fridge with the door wide open and you don't know what you're doing there? And I think most people can relate to that experience. And then if you even kind of bring that experience into every other aspect of your life, it's you'll see that there's so many of the decisions that we've made, we haven't really been involved in that decision making. It just somehow happened. So meditation is a way of kind of bringing a new awareness to everything that you're doing. And by doing this, you kind of realize, hold on, maybe I'm not actually doing what I want to do. Maybe I'm creating my own misery. And this is the opportunity that meditation affords.
In the book, you say that meditation is an alternative to thinking.
Yes.
Go on, explain yourself.
So one of the most interesting things when we begin to look at our minds, right, is that you begin to see that you are not creating your own thoughts. Like, you have no idea, Ray, of the next thing that you're going to think, in the same way that you have no idea of the next thing that I'm going to say. Like, we can close our eyes and we somehow, and this is the thing, we often, when it comes to thoughts, we imagine that we're the one in the driver's seat. But the reality is, and the reality becomes apparent when you observe your thoughts and study your thoughts in the kind of laboratory that is meditation. And that's when you see, hold on, I'm actually just the passenger here. And when we begin to kind of look at thoughts at another level, we recognize that the vast majority of our thoughts make us miserable. They make us stressed out. They make us worried. And this is just the nature of our brain. Our brain has been designed not to make us happy, but to keep us alive. And so once you can begin to see this, and when you can begin to learn to have a relationship with your thoughts where you're like, well, maybe that's not true. Or maybe I don't have to believe that. Or maybe I don't have to react to that impulsively. This gives you a kind of a beautiful freedom.
Hmm. So, thoughts aren't facts. What are the differences between emotions and thoughts?
Well, the difference, see, everything begins with a thought. And then the thought kind of will trigger an emotion too. And the thing about emotions quite often is that there's so many layers connected to them. But kind of from the point of view of meditation, is you'd really kind of, emotions can be handled in the exact same way as thoughts.
Okay.
Emotions are just naturally occurring things inside the body, in the same way that thoughts are naturally occurring things inside the head. The problem that we have with emotions is that they're often very confusing. You know, we feel anger when actually we're just really sad. So what meditation is, in a way, is it's sort of also just a way of kind of sitting with big emotions rather than running away from them all the time.
Yeah, like there's words in the book repeated again and again, like patience and silence and doing nothing.
Yeah.
And these are all passive enough words. But for all the passivity in the vocabulary, it's very radical, because what you are asking me to do, if I follow your lead, is to...
Yeah, if you join the cult, right?
is to leave behind everything I've sort of thought to be true for my whole life, you know.
Yeah, but Ray, what if most of the things you thought to be true were negative things about yourself?
Well, that's the thing. My wife read your book before I did, right? And she said,
"Yeah,
this is going to change your life, because he's from Kildare. He speaks your language." She says, "This is going to change your life. If any book can make you meditate, this is the one. This is the one. This is it."
Was she right, Ray?
What? Well, I was explaining to our listeners before you came on that I sort of crammed it, which is probably not the way to read it. So I will go back to it at a future date, hopefully in a couple of weeks, and read it at my leisure and do the exercises, because as you go through each chapter, you give a context and then you give an exercise, which is great.
Yeah.
Just at a
practical level, though, you know, like the vast majority of us, we wake up and our thoughts, like the first thoughts that hit us, are kind of tormenting thoughts. Now, we may not entirely realize this, but if you begin to look at, say, like the majority of our thoughts are worry or stressful planning.
Yeah.
And if you can begin to have a kind of a relationship with your thoughts, where you look on the thoughts in the same way that you might look on the wallpaper in a hotel room, as sort of, I don't particularly like them, but I don't have to worry about it so much. It can completely change your idea. Like, imagine waking up on a Monday morning with a Sunday morning feeling. And this is all just about your relationship with your thoughts.
Yeah. Because, you know, it obviously leans a lot on Buddhism, and the Buddhist belief is that life is suffering. And does meditation help us to deal with that suffering?
Yeah, what I think is sort of more applicable to a Western audience, I think, is to say that life is unsatisfactory.
Right.
You know, like when you say life is suffering, someone's like, oh, Jesus wept. Just, I don't want anything to do with this.
That, yeah.
But if you say that life is unsatisfactory, I think we can all relate to that. You know, you fall in love and then after a while you start to become narky with each other. You go on holiday and then after a while you're like, oh, the sun's a bit too hot. You know, where you kind of, you buy a car and you're very excited about the car, but after a while you're like, oh, Jesus, this thing is costing me so much. So it's sort of how... The nature of life, because everything is in constant change, means that things are constantly slightly unsatisfactory. And now what the teaching of Buddhism is that if you can then find your sense of happiness and your sense of joy and your sense of peace from within you by doing absolutely nothing, then you don't require things outside you. Now, this doesn't mean that you turn into a plant.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It doesn't mean that you go and you find a cave in the Kura Ray and, you know, we never hear or see from you again. But if you're aware of this and you have this in your head, it kind of just makes the suffering a little bit less. Your car breaks down and you're like, well, it was going to happen.
Mm.
You know, you sort of, you get a little bit older and you look at your face and you're not distressed. You're like, well, this is natural. So it helps you deal with the highs and the lows.
The irony of it all is, of course, Connor, is that doing nothing takes an awful lot of effort.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why people true. That's why people give up on meditation, don't they? Because it is an awful lot of effort. Like you tried it and then had to go back. You know, you went away from it and came back to it, didn't you?
Yeah, and this is also this is what I tell everyone who ever comes to me is, like, it's you do go away from it and come back to it, and then eventually you hit a point where you're like with all habits, where you realize, hold on, this is really good for me, and I don't ever want to let it drop again. But I think at the beginning, a lot of people, their problems with meditation are they feel that it's something you're supposed to be good at, and I actually think the harder the time you have meditating, the better the meditation student you'll become.
Mm.
If it comes really difficult to you and you just stick with it, that builds up the kind of resilience that's required to kind of keep going with it.
There's a quote from one of your grandparents. I don't know which one it is because I think they're all mentioned in it. Is it something to the effect that some things are better off felt and not telt? You do your best.
My grandparents from Belfast.
You're over 300 pages to describe what meditation is, but some people might go away from the book still not knowing. And until such time as you do it and do it successfully, in inverted commas, you won't understand what it is.
Yeah, and I think I made the analogy. I drew the comparison. Like we got sex education in school of Vera Klein from a nun, Sister Dominica. And I just remember thinking, like, we're getting sex. Here we are in a room where nobody's had sex and we're all talking about sex. And it's sort of similar with meditation. There's a book that's all about meditation, but really the felt experience is what kind of confirms it. You know, talking about meditation, it's a little bit like, you know, dancing about architecture or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Should everybody meditate? You believe so, yeah?
Yeah.
And can everybody
totally.
Can everybody meditate?
If there's breath in your body, you can meditate.
Are some people better at it than others?
It's not about that. I think there's some people who have more suffering and more kind of... I mean, for me, like I look on my early childhood as... like good fortune in a way. I tried to find success as a writer and contentment as a writer. I didn't get it. I tried to find a sense of contentment in relationships. I didn't get it. I tried traveling all over the world and trying to get contentment, and I didn't get it. So I feel in some ways fortunate that none of the avenues I went down looking for peace actually worked for me. So I think the more you've kind of, you can sense this feeling of dissatisfaction, the better a meditator you will be, because you'll actually invest in it.
You list your, what did I say, how many is it? 10 benefits that you got from meditating. Quit smoking and drinking and eating animals all the time. I can walk into a space full of strangers and not feel social anxiety. I actually, honestly, wholeheartedly love my dad and mum. Most of the time I love myself, and if I'm acting self-destructively, I snap out of it pretty soon. I'm happy more than I'm sad. I don't feel so competitive around other men. I have more time. I'm brave. Even writing this book was an act of bravery that I didn't think I had in me. I still get angry. I still get the blues. I still feel jealous and sorry for myself, but I tend to be able to make sense of it now. The old dread of confusion is lifted. And when the shit is hitting the fan, I understand at a deep level that every single thing will pass. And this is the thing that I'd love to talk to you for hours and hours and hours, but this no self thing, because it is again against everything we think we know, that we were born into the world with no sense of self, and then as we go through into our childhood and into our teenage years, we develop a sense of ourself from, you know, things we do and things that people say to us and our interaction with other people. And what you were saying, well, what meditation and Buddhism says is that's not a good thing, to have this sense of self.
Well, think about it this way, Ray. Like, our happiest moments as humans are the moments that resonate most with us are when we are doing something selfless. Like a great moment of kind of a heroic moment where you help someone, where you give, where you kind of, when you fully like listen to another person, when you bring a child into the world, you know, when you're there with someone who's dying, all these moments where it's not about you, it's about someone else, for some reason resonate so deeply with us. And I think that's a great example of how the less you can, and I'm not saying, I think like the concept of no self isn't really practical on a day-to-day level, but if you can try to imagine it as the less you're thinking about yourself, the better your life will be. Like, so for example, like when you think about yourself a lot, you're kind of always checking yourself out in the mirror. You're going, am I getting a little bit fatter? Or you're going, oh, what did I say to that person? Was that stupid? Will they be offended? Or, you know, because this is the lexicon of our thoughts is very negative. It's very judgmental. So you find like the happiest people are those who are less involved with themselves and are more involved with service to others.
This is a sort of a big philosophical question, Conor. I don't expect you to have an answer off the top of your head. But it is all of you are saying, it's sort of against what we understand to be human. You know, the human condition.
Ray, I think it comes down to this two things. And I think this is very much like we're talking about like the evolutionary process. Now, when you consider your thoughts, they are largely fear-based. So the thought structures that we have in our brains keep us afraid to enable us to survive, to enable us to procreate.
And they were keeping us alive. They were keeping us alive back in the day when we were running away from, you know, wild beasts and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. And when it was so important for us all to like have 10 children because 8 of them would die.
Yeah, right.
And so this is kind of still the pattern of our brain. So moving from that fear-based brain to a more expansionist brain is our way of kind of going from... So I don't think it's against human nature. I think it's just the natural progression of human nature, that as the world around us becomes at a day-to-day level safer, at a kind of an existential abstract level, it feels a lot more dangerous. But at a day-to-day level, like we're not getting chased down by tigers.
Yeah. So it's a way of silencing the lizard brain or the chimp brain or whatever they call it. You know, those things that worked well for our ancestors but probably don't work so well in the modern world.
Like Ray, if you think about it, the greatest threats to you and me now are anxiety and depression.
Yeah.
So if we can kind of move, and those things are all exacerbated by this fear-based reptilian brain. So if we can learn to just observe that yet not react to it, we can then move into a more expansionist brain.
Okay, Connor, let's make a date for this time next year. Okay, I'm going to go back to your book and we continue this
will
chat.
Will you finish the book by then, right?
No, well, I haven't finished. I finished it. I read it cover to cover, but it was very rushed.
I'm only talking.
Yeah. So this is it. Connor Creighton, thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us. I really enjoyed that chat. It's fascinating.
Thank you, Ray.
Thanks, Connor. We'll take a quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.